shoulda, woulda, coulda. Three words that give me the chills. I can't stand the thought of even using them. But having regrets is just a part of life. Even Frank had a few. And my biggest regret I've ever had in the music business was when Jeff Healey asked me to play with him twice, and I didn't immediately clear my schedule to make it happen. To be fair, it was at a time back in 2002 when our world was on autopilot in a constant merry-go-round of touring. We're still a very hard touring band, but back in 2002, our grueling schedule was starting to earn us the tag of hardest working band in the land. We reveled in the designation and we did our best to live up to it. But some of the fallout was being unable to do stuff on the home front, like take Jeff up on his offer. And his offer was simple. Come down to his bar, appropriately named Healy's, at the corner of Queen and Bathurst in downtown Toronto, and play a set with him. What an honor! Something I didn't take lightly, but I couldn't figure out when there would be enough space for me to do it, to learn the songs, to practice the songs, etc., etc. Whenever there would be free time, I would bask in the stillness and the silence. That's how chaotic things had gotten back in 2002. Every 6 to 9 months, Jeff's offer would pop into my head. I would casually go through a possible set list, and then the thought would pass. Until 2008, when Jeff passed away and the world lost one of its greatest guitarists, greatest musicians. Regret hit me like a punch in the gut. But it also taught me to never take weighty offers for granted. And since then, when an offer to collaborate would extend itself, I've always taken it. Some collaborations have seen the light of day, others haven't. But I can rest easy knowing that the words shoulda, woulda, and coulda are kept at bay for at least one more day. The two times I met Jeff were delightful. Here was a guy who I had listened to and watched since I was a kid, and he immediately talked to me like a peer. That's laughable even to me, knowing where Jeff perched on the lexicon of rock guitar gods. But he spoke to me like a bud. Maybe because I met him through his best friend, Roger Costa. So it made for a comfortable meeting. But I never forgot this first impression. Now that Jeff has passed, Roger has become the co-administrator of the Healy Estate and is carrying the torch, maintaining the legacy that Jeff built. Roger is someone I've known for about 2 decades now, from owning and running Monster Records on Yonge Street in Toronto, a store that I bought a few records from. During this year of 2016, Healy would have turned 50 years old, and with that, Roger has been able to release Heal My Soul to mark the Golden Jubilee, a collection of songs from the Healy vaults that showcase the more rockin' side of the man and the band. I had to bring in Roger to talk about Jeff, the new album, and the celebration that resulted from the album's release at Massey Hall this past May. You know, whether people know it or not, I've carried a little bit of Jeff around me for the last 15 years or so. When Jeff's old guitar tech, Keith Riddick, gave me a Strat guitar that had an old neck of Jeff's. Mind you, it wasn't one of Jeff's guitars, but it did have one of his old necks. I think I even told Jeff that. And for that alone, I treasure this guitar. If anyone has ever seen the black Strat I used to play with the mirrored pick guard and skull knobs, well, then you've seen that neck. Anyway, this podcast is supported by Skullcandy Headphones and Blue Mic Microphones. This podcast supports Chino Loco's Restaurants, Nippon Sopa, Strofe Waffles, and Three's Company Reruns. Please leave a rating or a review on the iTunes Store if you get a chance. I recently posted about this on Instagram, and I got a few people who did post a review and rating, so thank you very much for those of you who did. If you haven't yet, please do so. It really helps the podcast's profile on the iTunes Store, and it just really makes it makes the podcast look weighty in comparison to all the other podcasts that are up there. The more reviews this podcast gets, the more of a profile the podcast gets online and within the iTunes store. So please, if you can, please do it. Okay, here we go. Roger Costa is this episode's guest on the official Danko Jones podcast, and it starts now. The Danko Jones podcast is the best around. Nick Flynn, I get his Danko's go up, download for free. I'm so glad I like to sometimes. Jimmy in from fucked up, stop playing, hang down, down. What do you see in my future? What are you reading in bones? She paused for a while, flashing alligator smile as she told me Danko Jones.
I feel it's absolutely compulsory for you to listen to the Danko Jones podcast. Many times, Liz and I camped out in front of our Fisher 500 hi-fi receiver, hanging on Danko's every word. It's what we used for inspiration when we both starred in Under Milkwood. We even got Peter hooked by the end of the production. Peter O'Toole, that is. I implore you to go now and listen to Danko expound on subject matter most of us don't even think twice about. Listen to him turn anything into podcast gold. It's simply fantastic.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, get ready because the Danko Jones podcast starts. No!
You're here. You made it. I'm glad you're on this podcast. You are someone I've known for a super long time.
Way too long.
Way too long.
Yeah.
I guess we should just like cut to the chase. I've known you for 20 years.
Yes.
You know, it's 20 years.
20, yeah. 20 years.
And I actually met you through our mutual friend.
Fred. Yes.
And the way I remembered you guys was like, there's Fred and there's Roger. It's like Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. It's Fred and Roger, and you guys had the store. Yeah. Someone must have put that together a long time. Are you serious?
Seriously, I've never.
And you've never
when you
heard
said
that.
I'm like, wow, why didn't I think of that? No, I've never.
That's how I remembered you guys. It's like Fred and Roger. Fred Rogers owns, they own Monster Records. So I was like, Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. Monster Records is in...
No.
Okay, let's backtrack. You used to co-own with my bud, Fred, Monster Records. Then you bought Fred out. I used to work down the street. I used to come over all the time.
Yep.
And I got to know you very well, and now you're here.
Very true. And you're no longer working down the street.
No.
And neither am I.
No. You closed up shop, what, 3 years ago?
Five.
Are you serious? It's been 5 years.
2011. I was there for, had that shop for 14 years.
And it was a great store. It had secondhand records before the vinyl resurgence.
Yes.
Secondhand books, just really kitschy pop culture stuff. And I'm sure you had some real gems that came through that store over the years.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It was fun, right? I mean, it was not only dealing with all the crazy, wonderful people that came through the door and some not so wonderful, but it was all the crazy stuff that I would never, in any other circumstance, get to see. So, it was pretty cool.
Yeah, it was like the only store in Toronto where you'd walk in, and it was a great locale. It was like Yonge and Bloor, the center of the city. You'd walk in there, and there'd be like a Kiss pinball machine in, you know, in 99 or, you know, whatever, and crazy, weird blaxploitation posters and Battlestar Galactica, Lorne Greene era stuff. I would be down the street in the porn store where I worked. I'd close up shop because I hated it. And then I'd come over to you guys and just complain about the porn store. And then just go through your new arrivals.
Yeah, the porn store and the record store, and I think any other place that you worked during that period.
Yeah.
It was you would pretty much just drop by on your way home and complain. get it all out of your system so your family would, you know, not hate you.
And then I'd put, I remember I was broke, so I'd always put records on hold, and he had a little stash that never got bought. So now when I do that to other people, I'm like, I gotta buy them. I can't be like that. I was like that way with Roger. I can't do that anymore. So that's how I remember that. And there's one time I was going to buy this Power Man Iron Fist comic book. I don't know if you remember this. No. And you said, hey, that's really good. I read that. That's really good. I'm like, what? You read it? And I was like, you're supposed to look down on us. You're not supposed to be like us. You're not supposed to be one of us.
One of us.
You're supposed to look down on all the people walking in here and just like, I couldn't believe you were one. I was like almost offended that you actually like, you know, engaged in all this crap that we did.
Yeah. Sad but true.
But in the store, there was a section of Jeff Healey's What were they? 78s?
Yeah.
Jazz 78s, because he was actually, whether people realized it or not, more of a jazz head than a rock and roll person.
Huge, yeah.
And so he gave you his collection. And that's when I realized, found out that you and Jeff were best friends, not just friends, best.
Yeah. So the stuff I was selling in the store was basically his cast offs. He would go and he would, you know, go to some guy's barn and, you know, wherever he happened to be touring, and, you know, buy 1,000 records off the guy, and then he'd go through them all after they got all shipped home, and then he'd have a bunch of doubles, or he'd upgrade copies to better quality copies, and then he'd just bring them by the store, and we'd just sell them off for him.
It was a weird thing to have in the store, you know, right beside, like, a $6 million man doll, you know, and, like, some, like, Wayne Gretzky book. And then Jeff Healey's Jazz 78s, everybody. It's just a little more highbrow than the store called for. So I always thought that was kind of cool, though. It was a cool connection, though, with Jeff being a little bit a part of the store. And then through you, as the years rolled by, and these are like, we're talking about like 10 years onwards, I met Jeff through you. Jeff opened up his Healey's bar near where I used to live. Mm-hmm. So it was a real kind of like, I think it was like seven blocks away from me.
Yeah.
And I met Jeff there through you. He was really nice. And I spent an evening with him, like half an hour with him once at his bar. I don't think you were there. It was back in the backstage room to the little stage they had.
Yeah.
And it was basically Jeff trying to convince me to play with him.
Yes.
I was like, half of me was like, I can't fucking believe this is happening. And the other half of me was like, I have no time for this. I got to go on tour. What am I doing? So that remains one of the things I've always regretted.
Yeah.
Not taking Jeff up on him and putting everything aside when he offered it.
Well, but that ended up making for a great story for you too, when you actually did play the club originally thinking that Jeff was going to be playing with you, and then you found out that he was actually in Brazil and he called you, I think, the day before or something to apologize.
Yeah.
And then you went on stage and went off for like 16 minutes about
ripping on him in his own bar, just ripping on the owner.
And he absolutely loved it. He thought it was awesome.
I will tell you that, like, even though I made it kind of like just kind of a funny jab, I was super fucking disappointed. I was like, this sucks. This is the reason why I wanted to do this. And then I showed up to the gig. I did not know this, but two-thirds of Gatto were his backing band.
At the time,
so I actually ended up, like, you know, befriending Greg Gottowitz and Doug Inglis, and it was a fucking great night. Yeah. Like, because I was like, this is cool. And then Jerome Godbeau was there as well. So it was actually pretty cool. It turned out to be a fun night. But Jeff heard about, I guess through you, what I said on stage, and he goes, I promise come back. I promise I won't go to Brazil again. And then it was like, I think that was around 2002.
Oh, that was right when you were taking off too, right?
It was crazy. That year was crazy. Those 2-3 years were crazy. So that was my connection with Jeff. And then through the years, you know, obviously you guys are best friends and all this stuff, but now, one of the reasons why I thought, well, this is a good chance and a good moment to have you on. Not just to, like, have you on and just talk shit about, like, hey, you seen Breaking Bad? You know, like, none of that crap talk. But, like, some concrete stuff that you've been able to do with, you know, Jeff's legacy and continuing the legacy on. And they've happened in the last year. So... this past May, I was unable to attend. I wanted to be on stage. But you had this huge night to celebrate something, commemorate something of Jeff's, like 50th?
Yeah, Jeff would have been 50 this year. So we wanted to make it as big a deal as we could. We've been, for the last, well, since Jeff passed away, we've been, Jeff's wife and I, Christy, Jeff's wife, we've been working towards getting Jeff's name, keeping Jeff's name in the public eye and making sure that he's remembered at the level that he should be. Because, I mean, he was a brilliant musician. I mean, besides the fact that, you know, he's a friend, great guy, whatever. But he was a genius level musician. I mean, watching him play was effortless. Like he, you know, and there's obviously, you know, there's hundreds of thousands of hours of, you know, that went into getting to that level. But, you know, he could pick up any instrument and play, right? You know, and we wanted to make sure that he wasn't just the Roadhouse guy. You know, or, you know, or the Angel Eyes guy, right? So it was something that was very important to us. About 3 years ago, we started working on spotlighting Jeff's legacy and bringing it back into the public eye. So we, you know, redid the website. We started the first official Facebook page, you know, and now 3 years later, we just crossed last week 158,000 people on Facebook.
Wow.
And that's none of them are paid. They're all natural. And we get it's slowed down a bit in the last few weeks. It depends on the Facebook's algorithms or whatever. But we're still getting, you know, between... 300 and 800 likes, net likes every week.
Wow.
So it's cool. It's still going forward. And, you know, we've been working to try and get, you know, make sure that anything that comes out with Jeff's name on it is worthy of having Jeff's name on it, because there's a lot of stuff that we didn't have control over, after Jeff's passing that was frankly, you know, not as good as it could have been, should have been. Some of it should have never been released in the first place. Mm-hmm. So we want people to know now that if it's something that the estate is connected to, that it's worth getting.
Well, with this album, Heal My Soul, obviously these are tracks from the vaults. What went into choosing these tracks? How did you find these tracks? And what makes the release stand out?
Right. Well, this is an album that I've wanted to do for years. I was aware of a lot of the tracks on Heal My Soul for a long time. About 20 years ago. Okay, these were all recorded between 1996 and 98. Crazy, weird period in Jeff's life. They had just left their longtime record label, Arista Records. And Jeff's rock career and his life were kind of in free fall. He was in the middle of a divorce. The band was going through all kinds of bad friction. There was years of issues. They were a self-managed band, and you know, there was a lot of mistakes made along the way and friction that it builds up as these things do. And he was kind of sick of everything. And so he didn't know what he wanted. At one point, you know, they left Arista, and then a couple months later, he was clamoring to get a new record deal. They got a new record deal. They were on Atlantic for about 5 minutes. Then they left Atlantic again. And what was a regular routine for years of them, you know, recording an album, going on the road, coming back, recording an album, going on the road, turned into this 4-year period of just letting stuff out. And so Jeff recorded about 36 songs during this period, co-wrote a whole bunch of them. Ultimately in 2000, there was an album release called Get Me Some, which had 12 of those tracks on it. And it should have been a brand new chapter in Jeff's rock career. It should have been a big renaissance for him. Some of the songs were really powerful, stronger than anything he'd released before. But by that point, they had gone through so many hands. There were a lot of great producers involved, but unfortunately, you know, there was no real flow to the record because there were so many fingers in the pie sort of thing. And it suffered from it. There's a couple of missteps on the album. Anyways, so, but at the time, yeah. Jeff played me some of these songs, two in particular, Days of the Night, which is the lead off track.
Yeah, right.
And Baby Blue. And he loved these songs. Like he was so proud of the work that he did on these things. And I never forgot these tracks. And so it was always a case of, you know, wouldn't it be great if we could do this, right? But we need to have the right partners and we need to have access and all that stuff. Well, you know,
did you come up with this idea of the partners and stuff when Jeff was alive? Did you talk to him about this?
No.
Oh, okay. This is all after his passing. Okay.
So, I mean, I never forgot these tunes, but right. I mean, and had Jeff not, you know, passed in 2008, I probably would have eventually started bugging him about them again. No, this is something that I thought of afterwards when I was thinking of what was out there. And, you know, we'd sort of, you know, it's like the fantasy football, right? You start putting together lists of tracks in your head and you put that one in the closet and that should never be released and that shouldn't have, you know, but that should come out and that needs new drums and that needs this. And so, you know, just constantly going through these things. And, so we partnered up with, through friends of ours at Universal, we ended up partnering with a company called Convex, who have been great to work with. And, Mascot is distributing the album for the rest of the world outside of Canada. And so we basically were given the keys to the vault, and we were allowed to go in, and because we don't own any of the masters on this recording. They're owned by Eagle Rock. And they were great, they let us go through, and I already had a list of the songs that I was looking for and some that I only had titles on, that there was no reference tapes, so I had no idea what they sounded like. And I dug through and found all these masters, and then we got them all cleaned up and transferred to digital. And, you know, there's also specific takes that we were looking for, all of that stuff.
Like, was that all written down? Like, did you have some sort of some map to go through this with? Or
no. There was the minimal actual documentation. What I knew from... I'm also the archivist for the estate. And so what I knew was from going through the recordings myself. Mm-hmm. Jeff, in later years, mostly because of his frustration for the business side of music, he kind of distanced himself away from the stuff that he did with the rock band during that period. But he kept copies of these things with him through like 3 different moves, and they meant something to him, right? So I had those to go by as well. And there were specific things. Like there was for Days of the Night, that's the only song that had been previously released on anything else, but not this version at all. And the version that was released, in my opinion, was awful. It was a different solo, different vocal take. It was a completely different mix. It was a different song, in my opinion. So I had to find that one. And sometimes I had to go back to the vault 2-3 times where it's like, okay, I've got, you know, these three tapes that have, you know, 8 takes on them. It's got to be one of these. No. Okay. Got to go back.
And so he recorded Days of the Night numerous times, like more than a dozen.
Well, they would, there was a bunch of different takes. And really? So on some of those things, and it was pretty crazy. But
guess I'm revealing a little bit more about us.
Well, here's the thing too, right? Like at the time, the 90s were a good time, right? Like to be at the top of your game. And, you know, they had a mansion. Like it was the band mansion. It was just north of Casa Loma, right? They had built their own studio, they converted the garage to a studio, and you know, with a full, you know, multi-track board and everything. Like it was monstrous. So he would go in there, right, and just, you know, but push on record
on
and just
2-inch tape.
Like yeah.
Endless amounts of 2-inch tape. Yeah. That's pretty cool.
So he would go in and do all this stuff and just...
Very luxurious to do that.
Definitely. So for Baby Blue, for example, right? Like when he played me that, he was like, you know, I laid down like, you know, 6 harmony vocals on this. Check it out. It's awesome, right? And he was just so happy because he would just sit there and he would just go, okay, I'm going to do another vocal. Hey, you know what? I'm going to do another vocal.
I'm going to get up off this chair just after my coffee.
You know, it's funny because you'd get to these takes of the songs and... You know, there might be a scratch vocal and, you know, a good vocal and then like some other bits in there. Usually there was one solo. Like he would go in there and just let fly and that was it.
Right.
Right. And then everything else would build around that and get it's changed. It's like
from the school of jazz, really.
Yeah.
Right?
Sure. And I mean, the solos were always different. You know, like he rarely mapped out a solo and knew, he sometimes knew the beats that he wanted to hit, but quite often, and this will sound weird to some of the rock fans that are listening, but like he took a page from his hero's book, who was Louis Armstrong. And Louis Armstrong was the guy who basically started the whole, you know, improvising solos in songs. Like people would get, you know, like 2 bars, little riff in a song, and that would be it. But he was the first guy to say, take a solo, let's do this, right, and run with it. And so Jeff, you know, would basically lay down a solo off the top of his head, and honestly, like I was gonna say 9 times out of 10, 99 times out of 100, it was something just awesome. Mm-hmm. You know, just blow your head apart awesome. And that solo, like in Days of the Night, you know, that solo was burned into my brain from when I first heard it 20 years ago. And you know, when I heard the version that was released that was so obviously like more of a demo version, you know, and that solo was missing, like all the beats in that solo that, you know, I've got, you know, choreographed hand movements that go with them.
Right? But how did you burn it in your brain? Did you hear it more than once?
I heard it probably a couple of times, but it was just, it stuck with me. Right. But then, like I said, after Jeff passed and we're, you know, consolidating all the recordings that we had on hand and everything, and, you know, found that he had copies of these with him, that's the version that, you know, that he had with him. And it was just mind blowing.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, I mean, I've heard it, and what he did to you, you did to me. I mean, you played me a lot of snippets off the record. Yeah. And the one thing that was notable was a lot of people know Jeff as you know, an incredible axeman, but it's always from like the softer blues side. These songs are like really hard rocking.
Yeah.
Something that I think he wanted to, am I right to assume he wanted to kind of make sure people knew that side of him? Or?
I think, you know, like there was always that disconnect between, you know, the people who were the Angel Eyes fans.
Yeah, that's
and
what
then
I mean.
Going to a Jeff Healey show where, you know, it just melt your face at times, right? And you know, certainly, you know, like See the Light, whenever he would close his shows with that was like his anthem.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, depending on his mood, it could turn into this insane 20-minute Jimi Hendrix thing, right, where he's on stage by himself making, right, you know, crazy sounds with, right, his guitar. Right. And I'm sure that must have, you know, messed up the you know, the Angel Eyes Angel fans, Eyes, right? But it was all part of who he was. And I think during that time period, with all this shit that was going on in his life and that, I think that it was just, it was a way for him to just vent and get all of this aggression and frustration out. And, you know, it's just created something awesome. Honestly, in my opinion, and I've said this before, and people, you know, are going to be all over this in the, you know, if there's a comment section in the podcast or whatever, but in my opinion, even if I wasn't involved in this, this is the single best Jeff Healey rock release, period.
Because it is a rock release.
Yeah.
And when I say that it's hard rock, and I don't necessarily mean the solos, because you can lay a blistering solo down on Angel Eyes, you know, yeah. You can, mm-hmm. But it's the riffs,
yeah.
You know, the structure of the songs that I think take a turn to the harder than I think what Jeff's fans, what he became known for. Which was this kind of like crooning bluesman, you know, like this kind of, I hate to use this term, but the blue-eyed soul, like the blue-eyed blues or whatever, you know.
Sure.
Like, I use that term, you know, I don't like the term, but no. I'll use it in this case to just kind of describe what I mean.
Sure, and I get it. And that was something that he was known as the blues guy, and it's something that he fought against for years. I mean, he didn't.
Yeah,
sure. Blues were a part of his repertoire and a part of what he did and a part of what made him famous. But he really hated the label. Like he wasn't, you know, the blues guitar player. Yeah. He was a guitar player. He was a musician, right? And he had all of this stuff in him, right?
Well, when I've seen footage, I think maybe something you've uploaded online where it's like him playing a trumpet.
Yeah, yeah.
And he seems not out of his, he seems completely in his element. Like he's loving it more so than guitar. You could tell. But it's like this thing that I think as a rocker and being in the rock world, you run into jazz heads who have lowered themselves to play rock and roll music to pay the bills. But the real love and the real passion is for jazz. And as a guy who loves rock and roll first, when I've seen these people play jazz after I've known them for a long time to play rock and roll, there's this betrayal and there's this weird thing. Like you see them just loving playing this thing and you're just scratching your head going, how is this guy? I've seen this so many times before where he's just like blowing this trumpet. And I'm like, look at him. He's fucking loving it. Like more so than rock and roll. How can you love this more than rock and roll? Like it's this weird betrayal feeling I feel, but watching Jeff like playing trumpet on that footage I've seen you upload. I feel betrayed.
Well, you know what, for him, like it was the music, right? I mean, he just loved playing. And the jazz stuff, he was a big fan of the jazz stuff. And in a lot of ways, when he played jazz, it was liberating because, you know, he didn't have anyone telling him what he had to do.
Right. Right? It's very structured in rock.
Well, and when he was doing the jazz records, certainly. I mean, like his rock career, which, you know, to be fair... it was a product of its time. It was geared towards the hit. The record company would send you X number of songs, pick the songs you want to do. Yes, you're going to write some songs, but we're going to give you co-writers. All of this stuff.
Oh, really?
Was, well, in a lot of cases. I mean, like, there's a lot of songs in the beginning that came fully formed that he brought with him to the first record deal, See the Light, and a bunch of others. But they also, you know, got him to co-write with people, and the entire aim of the machine was to make more hits, right? Which is something that really, you know, got Jeff tired.
Yeah, right? I can understand.
Jazz records, he'd go in, he was running the show.
Yeah.
You know, there was no one telling him what to do. He would pick the tunes that he loved to do and he would run with it. And Jeff was happiest when the spotlight wasn't on him. He would go into, and there's so many stories of this, you know, whether it's a jam at his club or, you know, whether he's playing with the jazz guys, you know, he was happy to sit back and be, you know, the guy in the band. And it's like, yeah, hey, you know, you take the spotlight, right? Mm-hmm. One of the prime rock examples of this is Philip Sace. Amazing guitar player, super nice guy. He's got his own great career. He's a guy that Jeff was introduced to him. I think Philip was like 18 or something. Mm-hmm. And they were, I think, Pat Rush, who was his regular guitar player at the time, who had played with Johnny Winter and a million other people. Pat's a great guy as well.
Yeah.
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 But I think he was unavailable or something. So there was a tour coming up, and Jeff went, hung out with Philip, jammed, I think, at Grossman's or something, like everyone does, and then was like, come join the band. And Philip's head exploded, and he was like, what? Yeah. And he's like, come join the band. You know, you got all kinds of great things inside you. Come and go on tour with me. I'll show you how to play the big rooms. I'll show you how to play the big stages. And then you go off and do your thing, right? And so this kid, which he was a kid. He was an astounding guitar player back then, but he was a kid. Went on tour with Jeff, who had already had a 12-year career by this point in the public eye, right? And he would let him sing a song, you know, and he would let him take solos, you know, in some songs where Jeff, you know, wouldn't take a solo. He'd like, you know, you do it, right? I just want to be the guy sitting here. And then, you know, at the same time, you know, here's this kid who was, you know, full of all the stupid energy that we have when we're that young and excited, which, you know, I don't know how I get up in the morning these days, but, you know, but here's this guy, and he's like, you know, just slamming it, and Jeff is loving it, and he starts bouncing off of it, and it lifts him up, right? And he's like, you know, he's having a tired, bad day, whatever, they've been on the road for months, he, you know, and Philip plays this crazy solo, and he's like, all right, you know, that's right, bring it, now I'm coming back at you, right? So there'd be this interplay, and he just loved all that stuff. I mean, he would go, as in the later years with his blues band, which was called the Jeff Healey Blues Band for contractual, you know, legal reasons. It couldn't be, there's air quotes there for the people that are seeing me, because there was issues with the name, the Jeff Healey Band, which is a whole other podcast. But anyway, so they would go, and they he had a wicked house band, Dave Murphy, Alec Fraser, Al Webster, who plays drums with so many people. I think he's with Colin James right now. Dan Nordemir, a wicked guitar player. He would go, and their songs were, you know, he would let everyone in the band take the spotlight. You know, Alec would sing White Room. You know, they used to do, there's a video of it from the Nottingen Festival in Norway, where Dave does Highway to Hell, and Jeff just plays rhythm. You know, he gets up and he's goofing, and he flips the guitar around the in more quotes, the right way, and he's just having a fun, goofy time with it while everyone else is taking solos and belting out AC/DC at this blues festival, right? And he loved it, right? You know.
Well, I spent a day with Philip once. That's the day I met him. I didn't even know who he was, but JC and I were in Paris to do press, and it was one of the longest days of press we've ever done. And we showed up, we were to the lobby of the hotel where all the journalists were, and then this guy from Toronto goes, hey, I'm doing press too. I'm like, who, what's going on? And so we actually did our press days in tandem in the same lobby with the same journalists, because we both had the same PR people. Nice. And they figured we'll do it all two in one. And there were some, you know, journalists or mags that weren't right for either one of us, but we ended up spending the whole day together, the entire day. Nice. Because in the evening we did a radio show together, like late night on Paris radio. And then I've never seen him again. And then he pops up on your feed about Jeff Healey. He might have mentioned the Healey connection. I don't remember, but we just had the same kind of mutual. His brother was in the Deadly Snake, so I knew him from there.
Okay, right.
Yeah. So that's how
I didn't even realize that.
Yeah, my brother was in the Snakes, and so that's the avenue I remember him through. I don't remember if he mentioned Jeff, but so he pops up, and every time I see him, I remember that day, and that was I think in 2008.
Yeah.
So he was already kind of in Jeff's band by then.
Yeah, well, by then, Jeff passed away in March of 2008. So
this had just happened, I guess.
So Philip was in Jeff's band, like 99 to 2001,
kind of in that period.
And then he went on to be Melissa Etheridge's guitar player.
Okay.
I can't for the life of me remember the quote, but there was a. I don't know if it was Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. There was some big Grammy thing or something. I can't remember. I've just seen it on YouTube. But he's playing with Melissa Etheridge, and then John Bon Jovi gets up to do something and present an award or something. And, you know, he just, I can't remember the exact quote, but they had to beep him out. But he said something like, you know, who the fuck is Philip? You know, like, it was just like, that was awesome. Like, that guitar player was awesome. So, he kicks ass.
Yeah, it was funny because we were in Paris and suddenly we're thrust together with this guy from Toronto going, hand, like, he would be talking to a journalist and then their interview would be up. And then I'd sit in where he was sitting and I'd talk to the same journalist.
Yeah.
I think a couple times they're like, so are you friends? I'm like, I never seen this guy in my life. I've never met this guy. I don't know who he is. But you're from Toronto. I know. I don't know. So it was like that. It was just a weird day, and it was very long.
Yeah.
It was so long, and there's so many journalists that I did the interviews by myself, and JC did. We split interviews. It was just nonstop. And it was in the lobby of this hotel where we were just going around and around with Philip Sace. That's how I remember him. And every time I see him on your feed, I'm like, that's the dude I spent a day with in Paris.
And on top of everything, like, not only is he, you know, he's like the triple threat, right? I mean, like, the guy is an astounding guitar player. He has an incredible voice. He's like this golden god, this blonde, you know, California looking dude. And he is the nicest guy on the planet. He has, like, you know, no ego issues. He's
real
so
nice. I remember him being really nice, not standoffish like I was.
Oh, well, well, you're a whole other, you know.
Like, you're a whole other threat. I don't know about triple.
Well, it's like, you know, he's one of those guys where, and this is a real thing, like, you know, at the show that I guess that we'll talk about in a bit, like, he would go, like, when he got there and he's setting up his gear, he went around and introduced himself to all the crew guys. You know, like, it's just like, hey, you know, I'm Philip. Nice to meet you. What are you doing here today? Oh, awesome. You know, hope we have a good time. You know, like, it was just like, he's just so nice.
Yeah. No, that is a class thing to do. Yeah. JC does that.
Well, he always was the class side. Yeah, he's Danko Jones.
He allows for me to just, like, stay in a little corner and go, huh? but that's really nice. No, he was a really nice guy. That's how I remember him. And obviously to have been taken, drafted by someone as esteemed as Jeff, obviously very talented. And he did something I never got to do, which is jam with Jeff multiple times.
Multiple times. And that's one of the things he used to call it, the Jeff Healey University, like, going on those first tours. He would sit there and he would just, like, you know, just sit there with his jaw hanging open watching Jeff play, right?
I can imagine that would be someone who can understand it. Me, I'm more of a singer than I am of a guitar player, so a lot of that stuff would go over my head. I'd be just like, wow, how does he do that?
Well, there's a Godovitz, you know, tells a story about, you know, getting on stage with Jeff and they were jamming, and Jeff's like, you know, let's do. Someone asked for "While My Guitar Gently Weeps" or something, and he's like, yeah, sure, right. And Gatto's like, I don't know, you know, how to play it. I mean, I know the song, but I don't know. And Jeff's like, you know, just watch me. And Godovitz is like, like, it's like watching someone playing fucking piano. I don't know what's going on over there. Like, I have no idea what he's doing. And I'm like, all right.
Greg's great, man. He's great. That was one of the best times of the night, just hanging out with Greg Godowitz.
He had great things to say about you, too. And actually, I think it's on the recording where he's talking about, you know, I meet Danko Jones today, and he's this nice, quiet, shy young man, and he's so nice. And all of a sudden, he gets on stage, and he's like fucking Henry Rollins. What's going on here?
It was pretty funny. It was really cool. But this 50th anniversary show that you did in May was a huge event with a cast of characters, including Philip.
Yeah.
And who else was it? I don't want to say because I don't really remember.
Well, it was, we kind of went sideways. So I want to get back to the record after and talk about that. But yeah, the show, it was awesome. It was at Massey Hall, which is, you know, for anyone not in Toronto, is this sort of, it's it's 137-year-old building. It's this amazing, amazing venue in the heart of Toronto. And we were lucky to be able to do it there. And we had all these people come out. Philip Sace. It was a lot of guitars. which, you know, it's what we wanted. It was the show that we were building. And, there was guys from sort of everyone who played had their own unique sound. It wasn't a bunch of chuckleheads just getting up and doing Smoke on the Water. Like, it was all everyone. It's like, this guitar player sounds like that, this one doesn't sound like that. So it was Sonny Landreth, who's this amazing slide player who, you know, sounds like Steve Morse while he's playing slide. Like, I mean, it's just, it's this intricate, amazing, heavy stuff. The legendary Albert Lee, who he's played with Dave Edmunds and Rock Pile. I mean, Emmylou Harris, all these people. So he's coming at it from this like insanely virtuistic. There you go. Like country picking, but still like rock. Mm-hmm. Just flooring everybody. There was Walter Trout, who was straight up, you know, in your face, balls out blues, like heavy. Philip, you know, who has, I don't want to throw labels at him, but I mean, like there's a Stevie Ray Vaughan vibe going on. He's an amazing rhythm player and lead player. So there's his stuff going on. There was, the only, female that, we needed to sort of clear the testosterone out of the air for a bit, was this amazing singer named Shakura Saida, local. She's played with everyone under the sun as well, but she's known, you know, worldwide. She's just finished 2 months in Europe doing festivals. She was awesome. We had like a house band that played with everyone all night. There was the Trues, East Coast boys, top of the charts here in Canada, and they kicked ass. And the special surprise guest tonight was Randy Bachman.
Oh wow!
And Randy was amazing. Like, seriously, like 3 days before the show, he's like, "Okay, I got an idea." We're like, okay. So there was a house band that learned everybody's songs, and they played like all night long, right? There were six major acts and then a big finale, and these guys learned everything, right? It was insane. So I'm, it's like, okay, guys, I know this is a couple days before, but this is pretty cool. So what do you think, right? And, you know, they rose to the occasion. But so last year, Randy had released an album. It was a lot of guest people on it. There was Peter Frampton, and I can't even think. It was all these different amazing guitar players were on it with him. And he contacted us and said, "Look, I've got this great guitar solo from Jeff from a song that we jammed on in London. I want to take the solo out and build a new song around it." And we were like, "Yeah, sure, great, sounds awesome." And it came out really well. It was really cool. So what he did was he called us up like I said, 2-3 days before the show, and he's like, "Okay, here's what I want to do. I've got my guy, my engineer, to remix the song so that there's more of Jeff in it. And what I want to do is I want to get the band. We're going to play along. We're going to play the track to Jeff's track. And then one by one, everyone's going to leave the stage, and we're going to have Jeff's guitar on stage, and we're just going to like have his solo ringing out, and there's going to be an extra minute of solo of his on the end. And we were like, yeah, fuck yeah, that'd be awesome. So, you know, they did that. You know, the guys left the stage, the rhythm section left the stage, and then Randy Bachman and Pat Rush and Joe ended up staying there on stage, and everyone in the audience was clapping along to this amazing solo, and they just were like, you know, doing the "We're Not Worthy" to Jeff's guitar, and people lost their shit. Wow. It was awesome.
Wow.
It was a great, great moment. People had, like, you know, chills. It was so cool. And, you know, apparently, you know, you have to go.
Apparently someone wants to email me. No, that's amazing.
It was fantastic. So, so the night was filled with all kinds of stuff like that. And dude, I've been going to concerts at Massey Hall for, like, you know, over 30 years, right? This was the loudest, most enthusiastic audience I have ever seen. They started, and I can't make this shit up, man. They gave Philip opened up the show. He got a standing ovation after his first song. Every single song that everybody did all night got a standing O. Everybody. It was insane.
I should have played.
It was absolutely insane. And then, of course, at the end, right, because, you know, it's me, I have to throw in my my 1970s variety show moment in there, right? I got everybody on stage to do See the Light. So there was 11 guitars on stage, 19 musicians. Jerome and Shakura sang lead, and everybody took a solo, and people just, it just melted everybody's faces, man. They were like clapping for 10 minutes after it was done. It was insane.
Who are these people, and why aren't they just bust to every single show in Toronto?
I'm serious, man. They were so awesome. And it was funny because I ended up, originally we've been talking about, you know, we're going to get like some, you know, some radio personality to do the mm-hmm. thing. And then as the date got closer and people that we were thinking about weren't available, and then it was like, you know what, like, I'm just going to do this. Like, it's just, I'll do it. I've done similar stuff before. And so here I am, you know, I have no idea what I'm going to do. I have a rough idea in my head, but, you know, being on stage, it's not my thing. Right. So, you know, I just dove into the deep end and I was like, hey, here we are, right? And people just ate it up. They're, you know, like, people were yelling at me. I was yelling back. We're doing it. Was awesome. Okay. You know, like, at one point, you know, of course, that, you know, when am I going to be on Massey Hall stage again, right? Yeah. So I'm like, okay, I got to take a picture of everybody, you know. And then there's, like, you know, people on the, you know, stage right are like going, hey, over here. So I finally take a picture of you guys too. And it's like people were just like eating it up and running with it. And like, so anytime that there was the slightest hitch where I had to fill time, it was not an issue because everyone, you know, became a participatory, you know, program. Like people, it was great.
Cool. That's cool.
So, you know, I told some stories that every band that got up told some stories about Jeff. And it was a great, great night. And backstage, no egos at all.
Oh yeah, you can't.
Oh, it was insane.
But you can't.
But Massey right now is undergoing all kinds of renovations, right? So the dressing room used to be upstairs. There was no, and now they're downstairs,
okay,
cordoned off. So we had 19 musicians and 3 dressing rooms, right? So, you know, people were setting up in the catering area. So yeah. There's this tiny narrow office where someone was in there tuning their guitar. When we were sorting out details for everybody, Randy Bachman, you know, he emailed me and he said, yeah, so, you know, I'll just need this. And this is the kind of amp that I'd like to use. And, you know, I need a dressing room. But, and so when I called him, I'm like, dude, there's no, you don't have a dressing room. There's 3 dressing rooms for 19 people. I said, but you'll be in a dressing room with, you know, with Albert Lee, Walter Trout, like all the headliners will put you in the one room or whatever. And I said, I hope that's okay. And he laughed and he said, well, I got to share a dressing room with Albert Lee and Sonny Landreth. Fuck yeah, for sure. So it was great. Everyone was just so cool and laid back. And there was, like, you know, I joked about it, but on stage, but it's one of those cliched, stupid things that everybody says, but there was so much love in that room and everybody, like, it was overwhelming for everybody. It was really, that's really cool.
That's too bad I wasn't in town to go to the show. I would have loved to have attended.
Well, you know, we're thinking of maybe doing it again at some point. Everyone's been bugging us, so we'll see. I mean, even the union was awesome, right? Like, it's funny because, you know, we were running around trying to get stuff done, and, you know,
the union at the venue.
At the venue, yeah. They you know, they bent a lot of rules for us and stuff. And afterwards, the guy running Massey, the operation manager, was like, dude, this has never happened in, you know, the history of Massey Hall, that they have, like, typically the stage is supposed to be dark between 6 and 7. It's a hard, fast union rule, but they went out of their way to make sure that we got all the sound checks and stuff that we needed. Wow. The union, the whole thing was for charity as well, right? Like, we donated all the money to a World Eye Cancer Fund, which used to be called Daisy's Eye Cancer Fund. And it was it's a charity that deals with pediatric retinoblastoma, which is what Jeff had, which is why he lost his sight. Jeff's son has it. But through the work that they have done, like, when Jeff's son was born, like, they were actually able to test him in vitro. And so they knew that he had it, and he was treated at birth.
Wow.
And so he has better eyesight than I do now. Like, he doesn't even wear glasses, right?
It's like Lee Majors, 6 million.
Exactly. So anyway, so the union, they donated $2,500 to the charity.
Wow.
It was incredible. So I'm on stage. I'm like, you know what? People say this shit all the time, but, like, thank you so much to the union guys. And it was just so great. I mean, that was the kind of night it was. It was really special.
That's good. You said you wanted to get back to talking about the record.
Yes.
Were there some points that we haven't discussed?
It's awesome. Did I say that already?
No, that wasn't mentioned, actually. I don't think it was understood, so it's good that you mentioned it now.
The record is just it's just great. We're so proud of how everything came together and how it came out, and the guys that worked on it. My audio guys were amazing. Neil McDonald and Paul Cahayas from Echo Sound Studio Labs. They do a lot of work with Banger Films. They did all the incidental music and restoration for Super Duper Alice Cooper.
Yeah, I haven't seen that movie yet. I really want to see it.
You should. Yeah. It's really good.
I know.
We had to, because of the nature of the project, there was a lot of the drums weren't finished on the record. Like, there's a lot of placeholder drums. Like, there's electronic drums on one track, but a lot of times it would be whoever was in the studio at the time, whether it was the original producer or sometimes Jeff or whoever, just laying down a rough, very basic drum track. So we got a good buddy of ours, Dean Glover, who's an astounding drummer, came in and he laid his magic all over this thing, and it's cool. It's really good.
Now, getting back, I think we'll wrap it up soon, but I can't have you on this podcast about Jeff, and you mentioned it about the Massey Hall show where people were trading stories. Lay down a heavy Jeff Healey story. You gave me one that I've passed along secondhand to a lot of people about when they first played London.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So,
this is heavy.
So, I think that since the last time I told you this story, because these things go and go, it's like Game of Telephone. I've had it clarified now, so I know it's a lot closer to what really happened. So there was less people involved, but it was still cool. So they're playing London. It's one of their first big shows there at the Marquee Club. It's sold out. I think the album had just come out. He's getting some exposure on BBC. There was people. I've seen news footage because, you know, Toronto sent a bunch of cameras down there. Local boy does good and all this stuff. So interviewing people that, you know, went all the way from Germany to try and see Jeff play and everything. And they do this show. And I think there were some issues with the sound or something. And so, you know, they were already starting on stage to bicker, as all bands do, right? I mean, it's
especially at, like, big shows with a lot of pressure, it never goes the way you want.
For sure. And I mean, and it's, you know, it's something that I can't remember, someone maybe Paul Stanley, whatever, has talked about it being like a being in a band's like a four-way marriage or whatever. And
yeah,
it's tight. Like, it's tighter than a friendship because it's work and it's everything thrown in together. Anyway, so they play. Nobody else in the audience notices anything. You know, like the crowd eats it up. It's all great. They go backstage. And the band just starts screaming at each other. To Jeff and the drummer and Joe Rockman, the bass player, like all just, you know, at each other's throats, just yelling about stuff that went wrong, whatever, back and forth. And one of the road crew knocks on the door, and they open it up, and it's like, you know, what the fuck do you want? We're busy, right? And he's like, well, there's someone here to see. And it's like, ah, fuck off, you know, like whatever. And slam the door and just keep on arguing, right? You know, this little insistent little knock on the door again. And they're like, what the hell do you want? And this guy's like, you know, there's someone here you really should meet. And they're like, what the hell? Like, fine, okay, whatever, right? And you got to remember, this is like their first big jaunt anywhere, right? Like, yeah, outside of North America,
right?
Right? So they go, fine, whatever, right? So anyways, the guy goes back and gets the person who wants to meet Jeff, and it's Jeff Beck, right? And he was like, you know, that was awesome. It was great seeing you play. It was really fantastic. And, you know, and they were all just like, all of a sudden, you know, all of the energy got sucked out of the room. All of the argument was just, yeah, like, you know, just them feeling like complete asshats for... for all this. So it was just, it was a great moment. But these were, Jeff's career, his rock career was littered with these things, like, you know, people coming up to him and seeing him play for the first time. And, you know, initially being, I guess, intrigued by the way Jeff played, but then hearing what Jeff was actually playing.
Yeah.
Like B.B. King, B.B. King and Stevie Ray Vaughan were close friends of Jeff's. So many people, like, and everyone has, you know, super nice stories to tell about Jeff, because, you know, he was a musician's musician, but he also realized that when you're on stage, it's a show. You got to put on a show. People paid money. They want to see stuff happen, right? So, which is why, you know, you see in all the videos, whenever he takes his big lead break, he'll get up and run around the stage and stuff like that. He was like, people want to see that shit. They don't want to see some guy sitting in a stool for, you know, for 2.5 hours or whatever, right? So he ran with it.
Yeah, know? Yeah. Well, that's cool. I know I've heard a few more, but I don't want to keep you too long. But you could see it too on the walls of Healy's, you know, in his bar. There was like, it was littered with photos of him with, you know, notable rock and roll types.
Oh, great. And he was so low key about it, where, you know, he would just sort of mention something in passing, and I'd be like, how the hell do you know Bernie Marsden, you know, from Whitesnake? It's like, yeah, that's like, that seems like someone who would be outside of, oh, you know, we just jammed together one time. We were at a festival, whatever. Like, it was just very, you know, it was just, oh yeah, you know, he was a good guy. You know, the guy's in Deep Purple, you know, like he wound up, Ian Gillan asked him to play on his 2006 solo album. And the solo that Jeff does on that record is mind blowing. You know, all kinds of stuff like,
yeah,
that, right?
Yeah.
Like, there's so many people that he knew that, you know, have fond memories and good thoughts, right?
Mm. Well, thanks, man. I think we're going to wrap it up.
Well, thank you.
Thanks for coming down. And let's end it with a track from Heal My Soul.
Sounds great.